Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. David McCross serves as Deputy General Counsel at the New York Times, a job he also held at the Daily News before coming to the paper of record in 2002. In addition to teaching at NYU School of Law and Harvard Law, McCraw is the author of a new book that is getting a lot of attention in these news war days, Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in the Age of Alternative Facts. McCraw is a graduate of Albany Law School, and he'll return to campus for a discussion and book signing on Wednesday at 3 p.m. First, he joins us. David McCraw, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you for having me.
How did you end up at Albany Law School?
I was a professor at Marist College. I was teaching journalism, and I wanted to get an advanced degree, and Albany was more or less my neighborhood law school when one lives in Poughkeepsie, and it was a great decision for me.
I understand that you're a trustee of the school?
I am. I have been for a couple of years.
What does that entail?
The board meets four times a year, and we oversee the operation of the school. We're ultimately the responsible people for finances and for the policies that govern the institution.
Okay, let's talk about your other job. Could you describe a typical day, if there is one, at the New York Times and what you do?
Probably not a typical day, but it's easy to think about what I do is in a series of categories. One thing I do that's important is I work with the reporters to look at stories in advance, make sure they're legally sound, try to avoid lawsuits if we can do that. If we do get sued, I'm going to be involved in responding. If we get a complaint, I'll be involved in that response as well. One of the things we do a lot of here is bring lawsuits on behalf of our journalists against the federal government, against the state government under the Freedom of Information laws. We also go into court and try to seek access to court records. Unfortunately, a big part of my job lately has become security. It's an increasing concern for anybody who's in media. The number of threats is way up, and we have to take a different posture than we did 10 years ago.
Why is that?
I think that it's a reflection of polarization, and it's the reality of social media. I think people who are not truly threats feel impunity when they're sitting at their computer and angry about something, and they write to us. They feel anonymous. And as I said, most of those people probably aren't really threats, but we don't know that. We have to take them seriously. We see the words. And I talk in the book about trying to talk to reporters about this and trying to encourage people to be resilient. But I, at that point, had a whole file cabinet full of angry letters that people had written to reporters.
The Times obviously has reporters all over the world. How does the U.S. compare with other countries in terms of press freedom as we speak here in the first part of 2019?
We still have a vibrant commitment to the First Amendment. We still have press laws that protect our reporters and journalists across the board, with the possible exception of protection of sources. But what we're seeing abroad is really troubling. The worst governments and the worst places are now trying to emulate the language of President Trump. Only there they are passing fake news laws. They're truly oppressing reporters locally, as well as those international correspondents that come in. We are under investigation, a criminal investigation in Egypt. We have reporters who are barred from coming into Pakistan. The Chinese block our website. And it's concerning to me because I fear those governments think that that's the way to curry favor with Washington, is to deal with the American media as biased or fake news, and it's just not the case. One of the things I really try to do in the book is lay out how that piece of the reporting puzzle has become something of great concern to me and something I deal with, whether it's responding to kidnappings or standing up to governments who are making it hard for our reporters to work in their countries.
Despite what the president says, are there people in government, at state, in the administration who are making that case to foreign governments on behalf of the Times and other outlets?
It's hard to say. I talk in the book about how the State Department used to think of one of its roles to be spreading the gospel of freedom. In the Bush administration, I went out and I spoke in the Middle East, I spoke in Central and Eastern Europe about the importance of a free press, how that has to be a component of democracy. Now it's a concern to us. We still have reached out to the State Department from time to time. We've received some assistance. We're just not sure if that's a consistent response. We're not sure what they say to other governments. I think in the past we were pretty confident that they were working on our behalf. The book talks about the investigation in Egypt when we ran a story that displeased the Egyptian government, even though it was absolutely true, or maybe that's why it disturbed them. And what we went through as we tried to respond to finding ourselves under criminal investigation in a foreign country.
Let me just go back to something you said a couple of minutes ago before I move on, which is part of your job is responding to lawsuits or the threat of lawsuits. Do many people sue the New York Times?
They don't. We have a couple of libel suits a year, and we have successfully handled those over time. The law is very strong here. We have a lot of defenses, we as well as everyone else in the press. I think there was a concern that because the president was talking about changing the libel laws, that would encourage people to bring libel suits. The thing that I find really important about libel suits and thinking about libel suits is that while technically they're about protecting reputation, they're usually about silencing the press or silencing speakers that someone doesn't like, someone's opinion has offended somebody who's powerful enough or rich enough to have lawyers, and that's what they're really about. And I think that's one of the great things about what's happened in America since Times versus Sullivan, the leading libel case, was decided by the Supreme Court in 1964. The courts have recognized that libel suits shouldn't be a weapon to stop speech that people disagree with. And I find it interesting that last week the president lost a libel suit on appeal in New York, where he's the defendant. He's being sued for what he said, and he's going to use in that case the very same defenses that we use. I would think he should be lining up on our side of the ball.
Well, I wish it to you. I don't know if that's going to happen.
You don't think that's going to happen? Okay.
Maybe not. You brought up Sullivan. What was your reaction to Justice Thomas's recent writings on the Sullivan case?
As you know, Ian, he came out and said that it was time for the Supreme Court to review Times versus Sullivan. He didn't think it was properly decided. And I found that fascinating because I think if you went out and talked to people on the street about what are the big problems facing the United States, what are the things that we should be concerned about, no one is going to tell you, you know what we need is more libel suits by rich guys. that is not one of the leading problems in the country today. I'm not concerned at this point. The glass is 1/9 full. He issued that concurrence as part of a decision in a libel case. Nobody else signed on to that case or signed on to his concurrence. I think the law made a whole lot of sense in 1964. The Supreme Court recognized in 1964 that libel suits were being used by Southern office holders to try to get the Northern press to stop talking about civil rights. That's what Sullivan was about. Police commissioner in Alabama, $500,000 verdict for him in Alabama. And the court stood up to that and said, we're not going to allow libel suits to be used in that way. I think the same thing would happen now if the standard shifted. The other thing I'd point to is that today of all times, when people have so much access to respond, to come back into the marketplace of ideas with their point of view, this is not the time to be changing the law.
Let's talk about President Trump. You had a very famous viral letter sent to his lawyer during the campaign after the Times ran a story where two women were quoted as saying that Donald Trump had touched them inappropriately. And effectively, if I'm summarizing you correctly, you responded that there was no libel case here because it would be impossible to impugn the character of someone like Donald Trump. Do I have that basically right?
I would refine that a little bit. I said that in respect to his reputation about the treatment of women, that was true.
Okay. In the public comments he makes about fake news and the enemy of the people and so on, are you seeing a sort of lasting effects of those statements beyond just, you know, the daily rhetorical war?
I do think that they are hitting home, and it concerns me. I talk in the book about why fake news is such a troubling label, and that's what it is. It's a label, and that the reason it's troubling is it sounds like the pursuit of truth. Somebody who's concerned about news being fake, when in fact it's just the opposite. It's an invitation to label and not think. And what we need really desperately right now is that all of us, wherever we are in the political spectrum, wherever we are in society, that we are taking seriously our obligations as citizens to read a lot of different sources, view a lot of different sources, listen to a lot of different sources, and make up our minds independently. I saw a poll last year that said 26% of the people who answered that poll thought that the president should have the power to close down news organizations that misbehave. That kind of number really concerns
me. That's incredible.
Yeah, it really suggests that something fundamental has been lost about understanding how a free press works in society. I grew up in Illinois in the 1960s and 1970s, small town, very conservative town, son of two veterans. And one of the things growing up at that time in Illinois, one learned was the governors went to jail. Governor Kerner went to jail. Governor Walker went to jail. Third governor was charged but managed to beat the charges. And we came away from that with the understanding that government should not be trusted easily. And it's unfortunate that idea, which used to be at the center of conservative ideology, has kind of fallen away.
There was a very famous moment during the Bush administration when the Times had learned of the warrantless wiretapping going on by the government. And basically, the White House pleaded with the Times and the editor, Bill Keller, at the time, not to publish, and said, effectively, there'd be blood on your hands if you published. And I'm wondering, given the rhetoric around fake news and the fact that the president goes after the Times almost, you know, seems daily or weekly by name, are those conversations still possible when it's an issue of public safety, perhaps, or national security? You know, because I noticed recently that the publisher was invited to the Oval Office to speak with the president. So is there still sort of an operational relationship?
That relationship goes on. Our editors are still in communications, and when there are sensitive story with the government, it's very important people understand the government doesn't have a veto. But just as when we're doing any kind of story, you want to hear from all of the stakeholders, all the parties who are going to be affected in some way by that story, and that's true with national security. Those stories are really tough. You never know all you need to know to make that decision. Should I publish or should I not? And the government obviously is going to take a position that you shouldn't publish in almost every case. Now, the conversation will sometimes become more nuanced, and the government will say, this is really a concern. This could cost lives. Well, over here, this may be classified, but it's not the same level. President Obama famously said, there's classified and there's classified, which is the reality. Too much gets classified that doesn't need to be. In the book, I try to take people behind the scenes and how those decisions work, because we ran a story about cyber attacks on North Korea shortly after President Trump came into office. And it was our first time really dealing with a sensitive national security story under a new administration. And I try to help people see how that unfolds, how the reporting goes, how the lawyering goes, how the decision-making ultimately comes about to go ahead and do a story like that.
Okay, along those lines, what do you think is one of the bigger or the biggest misconception the general public has about how the Times journalists work?
I think I get a lot of questions about anonymous sources, and I understand why people are concerned about anonymous sources. Look, every time we do a story, every time anybody in journalism does a story, the public benefits from knowing who our sources are. The reality is, though, there are certain times when we have to rely on anonymous sources to tell truths that the public needs to know. that comes up time and time again. But I was at a conference, and somebody stood up and said, I'm a big believer in the free press, and I really support the Times, but I don't like anonymous sources. How do I know that's not the janitor? And I'm here to tell you, it was never the janitor. It's never been the janitor. Now, there are good sources and bad sources, but it concerns me that, that there's this misconception that somehow anonymous sources are used to hide something that, that no responsible journalist would ever do.
This is probably more of an ethics question than a legal one, but what did you think of the Jill Abramson plagiarism controversy?
I think you're right about that. Here's, and I obviously don't have any insight into what happened. Jill's book raised a really important point, though, and I touch on it in my book as well, but not to the extent that, that she does. And that is, in the pursuit of readership, in the pursuit of financial survival, are news organizations compromising their duties and their obligations as journalists to tell the public the truth and get at stories that matter? And I think that's a reality as we move into year after year of tougher economic times for most news organizations. They need to find ways to get revenue, and we have to serve the public. But there are times when we have to give to the public hard truths that they may not really be that interested in, or they may not want to hear. We still have to do that, even if it's not part of economic viability.
I guess the reason I was asking the question is you were trying to explain how buttoned up a lot of this reporting is and how seriously journalists are taking the mission. But when you do hear criticism of the press, they only need one or two examples to say, hey, look, here's a case where the editor of The Times is being accused of plagiarism. Here's Jason Blair. Here's the Iraq war coverage that got a hard second look. So even though most of the reporting on a daily basis is not in question, it just takes a couple of bad apples or a bad example to sort of fuel that fire.
That is right. We have to be doubly concerned today about getting it right. We've always been concerned about that. It's part of what makes us who we are, and it's part of the value proposition we have for our readers. But in the current environment, when there's so much scrutiny and you're going to be attacked and your motives are going to be questioned, it becomes all the more important to get it right. I talk in the book about how in the middle of that first onslaught of criticism from the president about the press in the early days of the Trump administration in 2017, we ended up having to do a significant correction, clarification in a case involving a drug case. And it really had nothing to do with politics or what was going on in Washington or any of that. But it reminded us that every part of the newspaper contributes to our reputation, and we have to be concerned about it.
We've been speaking with David McCraw. He's the author of a new book called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in the Age of Alternative Facts. He is Deputy General Counsel at the New York Times, and on Wednesday, he'll be at Albany Law School for a discussion and a signing starting at 3 p.m. David, thanks for your work, and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.